John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's almost like a day of celebration right now, the way things are in this town with the success and great performance by James Paxton throwing a no-hitter last night. I mean, just very, very, very eventful. And certainly, I mean, a lot of reflecting, and we're going to do a lot of reflecting during the course of this show, try to talk to as many people as we can, because obviously this was a big moment in sports. You don't have moments like this. I mean, Felix Hernandez, I still remember when Felix Mora had his no-hitter, and I had some people from CenturyLink here, and one was working outside, and so and doing a good job trying to, you know, put the lines in and all that stuff. I went over to him. I says, "You got to stop that right now and come inside and watch Felix."
Oh, that's awesome.
And he was so dedicated that you know, he stayed outside working on the line. And what I ended up doing was taking my cell phone and making sure that he was able to see it. So I got the cell phone with the TV on, and so he was able to see Felix's no hitter as he was concluding that. But that was a big one last night, and just an incredible performance. But I think that might be leading off the five biggest stories of the day. The top five is brought to you by Eastside Plumbing Funding.
Number one.
Paxton ready. Here's the windup in the 0-2 pitch. Swing and a one-hopper to third. Seager's got it. Toss across. It's over. James Paxton has just thrown a no-hitter. The big lefty is getting mobbed out of the mound. The lefty from Lander, British Columbia, has thrown the sixth no-hitter in the history of the Seattle Mariners franchise. The young man from British Columbia throws a no-hitter against the Blue Jays north of the border here at Rogers Center in Toronto.
I don't know where you want to rank this in moments in Mariner history. This has to be one of the best. And, of course, we are taking you around the diamond thanks to Chain Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Because, I mean, this was such a magical performance. I mean, he did everything right. I mean, here he was. He had 42 pitches by the fourth inning. And this comes after a performance where he had 16 strikeouts in seven innings in a game that he didn't get the victory. Well, here he was with a no-hitter, struck out seven, had 99 pitches, and went the distance in a 5-9. Nothing victory. But here's the thing that was so impressive, along with the fact that he was just so dominating, that he was able to have his final three pitches at 98 and 100 miles an hour, and then finally the last pitch at 99. He was just rocking. And so there was an impressive diving stop that was made by Kyle Seager to save what could have been a double. You need those type of plays. But what was so special about this, along with the fact that he entertained and only had 99 pitches, was it was in Canada. And of course, what you're talking about is a British Columbia native was able to be only the second Canadian to throw a no-hitter, joining Dick Fowler, who threw one back in 1945. So this was history. It's the third no-hitter this year. Sean Manaea of the A's was able to get one. You had the combined four pitchers in the Dodger game down in Mexico over the weekend, but this one was phenomenal. Manaea's game was so good too, but Mora, this thing was even better, the way that Paxton was just able to just flat out dominate.
Yeah, and just how happy the team was for him. I hear from everyone that you just can't meet a nicer guy. I haven't met him personally. It was so cool to watch how excited Ryan Healy was when he caught that ball from Seager to tag Pilar out. And then I don't know if you saw, Shannon had a story up last night. She said that Felix had gone into the clubhouse at some point before, you know, he realized it was going to turn into a no-hitter. And she said he's so superstitious that she saw him like in the ninth inning, and he was like, I don't know what to do. He wanted to come back out, but apparently he thought that might ruin it. He didn't mm-hmm. want to change anything. So she said that she confirmed with him after the game, he did wait until the end of the game to come out, even though he wanted to be a part of it because he didn't want to ruin it.
Well, we'll get Shannon to tell even more of the story and just the reaction, because obviously all morning with Paxton joining Brock and Salk this morning at 7:45. I know they replayed that at about 9:30. I mean, this is such a special moment, and we're going to reflect on that really the course of the whole day. So that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business.
Number two.
Mariners look to keep the excitement from Paxton's no-hitter rolling today with Wade LeBlanc taking the mound. Game starts at 4:07. You can hear pregame right here on 710 ESPN starting at 3:00.
So that was the 20th win for the Mariners, and now a chance to maybe see if they can win this series. It's a three-game series, a seven-game road trip. Wade LeBlanc goes on. He's facing Jamie Garcia, and Jamie has, of course, struggled in his two outings. He's given up six runs in three and a third innings, so he's not done well. And what they're trying to do right now is get everything set, because this is going to be a real tough makeup game that's going to be coming up here pretty soon, because they have to make up the one game in Minnesota. So there's going to be seven games, three trips, and that's going to really take some time. And now what's doing is that you can see that Scott Service is trying to find ways to give some guys some days off. And so with that in mind, that's going to be one. And of course, the Blue Jays have their own problems. Roberto Osuna was arrested on charges of assaulting his girlfriend, and so he's on paid leave right now, and so he's not going to be available as a closer, and he's one of the better closers in baseball. So LeBlanc goes against the Toronto Blue Jays tonight, 4:07, 3 o'clock in the pregame.
Number three.
The latest coming in from Vegas has the Seahawks win total over-under set at around 8 wins, tied with the 49ers for last in their division. Good. That means nobody's buying into what they're doing. It means nobody's buying into this draft. In fact, I think that number has gone down since before the draft. Great. I love that everybody hates the Seahawks offseason. I love that the national folks don't get it. It reminds me of how things were back in the day when nobody understood what the Seahawks were up to. And you know what? It worked out just great then. I have a feeling it's going to work out pretty well now as well.
So, of course, that's going to be the predictions that you start seeing, particularly now that everybody's had the draft. I mean, you've got free agency, at least the unrestricted part, finished up yesterday. So now everybody's making their picks, and Vegas is kind of saying 8 wins. I've seen some where Vegas has had it at 9.5, and I know we're going to be on school with a professor next week. We're going to be talking to somebody that actually had it as low as 3-4 with the metrics where they're only favored in 3 or 4 games. But it's one where I think the bigger surprise is that the 49ers are up at 8. Some even have the 49ers up at 9, looking at the ones that at least have the Seahawks at 8. The Rams right now are a 9-win team. You have about 5 teams at 10, and the top of the NFC right now, 3 teams, I think Philadelphia, Minnesota, and Green Bay, each at 10. But right now the forecast is at least 8 games coming from Vegas. We'll see where that goes.
Number 4.
Man, we won 2 championships in 3 years. We're not about to run off talking about how bad we want to play somebody. Like, we want to win another championship. And it don't matter who's in the way of that. If you're in the way of that, then you happen to be in the way. But, we're not about to run around like, yeah, we want to play them in the conference final. For what? Like, it don't matter who else we play. However, we got them. All right, now let's get it. We get to it now. But it makes no sense for us to run around. We want them as bad as they want us. For what?
And so that's Draymond Green after the victory last night by Golden State as they blew away the Pelicans. And, of course, now it's going to be Golden State going up against Houston. And Draymond Green doesn't seem to care one way or another who they play. But this is going to be a very good series to see if Golden State can advance. Because I think in many ways, I know that the Cavaliers are still the team that everybody wants to match up and still get to the finals and take on Golden State. But I think this could be a tougher matchup against Houston. So it's going to be coming up here. I think the series is starting pretty soon. Celtics, meanwhile, trying to wrap up their series. They go against the 76ers tonight at 5, and all set. Cavaliers are already in the books. They've been taken care of, but Golden State last night advancing and winning the series in 5 games.
Number 5.
Well, if you want to look at the bright side in the wake of Mark Ingram's 4-game suspension, you can say that if any team is equipped to lose a number one running back, it's the team that had 2 number one running backs. The Saints will obviously rely heavily on second-year pro Alvin Kamara now without Ingram in September. And Kamara proved he can do everything. He can run, he can catch passes, he can work at the goal line. But the Saints clearly loved having both of those guys doing it. They were truly a 1A, 1B last year as they became the first duo in NFL history to both get more than 1,500 yards in a season and both go to the Pro Bowl together.
Well, Mark Ingram is, of course, getting a 4-game suspension, and I know he's fighting it. He says he didn't really take his attorney said he didn't take an enhancing drug. But again, he had something in his system, and when it gets in your system, you have the problems, and of course, you're going to get the suspension, and that's the way it goes right now. Big blow for the Saints, but as Mike Triplett just said from ESPN.com, they have Alvin Kamara, who, of course, was the Rookie of the Year last year. So that's going to be a tough break for the New Orleans Saints. In the meantime, John Mara, the owner of the New York Giants talking about Odell Beckham. And you can tell there's already frustration in the sense that they don't know if they can get some kind of a deal done, but they just say, hey, it'll get done when it gets done. But right now, it's not even close to getting done. Hey, you can listen to my show in the 710 Sports app, driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Well, coming up next, we're going to get together with Shannon Dreyer and get the reaction of what was going on last night with the no-hit game by James Paxton. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
And normally at 10:15, we do go into further review. So what we're going to further review is the no-hitter last night. And joining us in the Venue Kings hotline is Shannon Dreyer. And Shannon, how special was last night? And where do you think it would rank for not performances in Mariner history, but just in Mariner history? What was that game like?
I think in recent Mariner history, it was, absolutely near the top. And I think it was especially special because this is a guy that came up through the system. This is a guy that Mariners fans have known for so long. He's somewhat local. I know we make such a big deal about him being Canadian and getting that in Canada, but, I mean, he grew up just down the street or up the street from Seattle. So he's somebody that we've watched for so long, somebody that I think we've all had the feeling that stuff-wise he had that potential. We all know he's a great person on top of it, and we've had the time to get to know him. So I think that, kind of a magical season for him. Everything from that eagle landing on his shoulder to 16 strikeouts to the no-hitter in his home country, it was just absolutely amazing. And it was amazing how fast it went by. I mean, there was just so little question to what he had going last night. You look up and it's the seventh inning, and he had that. I don't think there was much of a chance that he was going to let that get away. So it was a pretty amazing night.
Yeah, it really was, and I think that, just so much fun to be able to watch. What's happened to him in these last two starts? Because he showed the potential in the game over the weekend that, he can go out there and be like a no-hit pitcher, with his 16 strikeouts, and then he comes back and tops it by throwing a no-hitter.
I actually wrote about this on 710sports.com. There's a post up about it, and three starts ago right before his start in Cleveland, Mel Sottlmeyer Jr. sat him down. I believe Mike Zunino was in there, too, and said, look, you've got the stuff. And it was a matter of we've looked at him, and I think we've all had, ideas the last couple of years that if he hit on the right night, you could see this. But the key with James Paxton is he should be that dominant every night. Not no-hitter dominant, but with the stuff he has, it shouldn't be an in-and-out thing. He should be able to he should be an ace. He should be at the top of this staff. He should be up there with the Justin Verlanders of the world. His stuff is that good. And the stuff that you see right now really isn't that different than what you saw at the beginning of the season, than what you saw last year. And it was a matter of putting it together in his pitch sequencing and setting things up early so he had those put away pitches and he was able to use the breaking ball late like he did last night, and believing that his fastball is basically unhittable. And that was the conversation that was had with him. And he was to the point where he wanted to be there, too. And so he put just a lot more trust in the fastball because he's a thinker. He's a guy that breaks everything down. The work that he does in season is tremendous. The work that he does out of season is perhaps even more. And a lot of times it was just trying to get his body right and finding every avenue he could so he could avoid the injuries, but kind of his dedication to his craft. Sometimes I think maybe got a little too much into his head. It made him perhaps forget a little bit the raw stuff that he has is that good that he can just go out there and, as Mel Sottlmeyer Jr. said, let it eat. Just let it go. And he was able to do that more in the last couple of outings. And two outings ago in the 16 strikeout game, it was all about that fastball. He didn't need anything else against the Oakland A's. And what's so remarkable is that this game that we saw last night and the 16 strikeout game were so different in that it was all stuff. It was all fastball in that first game, in the 16 strikeout game. And the no-hitter, he pitched a little bit more, yet was still able to reach back and get 99 and 100 in that last inning. And I think he finally knows what he has, how difficult it is to hit. And it's kind of been a case of the mindset and then also just the sequencing and the pitching smarts coming together.
Yeah, the reaction with his teammates in that, because I'm sure as happy as he was for himself, his teammates were probably even happier experiencing this.
It was fantastic. And a lot of times it was funny because James Paxton actually talked about this after the 16-inning strikeout game, in that, you know, a lot of times no-hitters, there's a lot of luck involved and you get a lot of help from your teammates. I didn't see luck last night. I did see help from the teammates. And so when everybody was so involved in that, and this group is a tight-knit, close group that really feels like they can do something this year anyway, so to have that and have it on the heels of kind of one of the rougher spots of the season, they haven't had very many, but that series against Anaheim was tough and disappointing for them. And to have this right on the heels of that, and a guy that a lot of them have been with for a long time, it was huge. And you felt that kind of genuine, you know, affection for each other, for the team, for what he did as an individual, and kind of where they are right now as a 25-man roster. And so it was just absolutely special to see kind of that moment on the field after.
Mm-hmm. And how emotional did he get?
You know, it was funny because this is a guy, I remember his second start, I believe it was, in the big leagues. It was in a sold-out Busch Stadium in St. Louis. And he had just come up from the minor leagues, and he pitched the entire game, and I got him afterwards. I think he threw 8 innings in that game. And he had no idea that there were upper decks in the stadium. He had tuned everything out, and he had the ability to do that. So to see emotion from him, to see him just put his arms up in the air, and the look on his face was, you could tell it was taking a second to process it. I thought that he was very emotional, but also very composed in the moment, and that's James Paxton. And it just, I think it's one that kind of sinks in as he gets the phone calls and gets to the clubhouse and hears them playing "Oh Canada" as he walks in. He was pretty emotional, but I think it's something that's just going to keep coming.
Was it that much more special that it happened in Canada for him?
It was funny. He said that was special, and he said the only place that would have been more special would be at Safeco Field. So it's, I think, you know, it's a balance with him, and he has the maple leaf on his arm, and they were asking him to show that on TV here last night, which was pretty fun. So, yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of extra there, but I think he would have been absolutely fine if that had happened in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. No, that was so great, and, of course, to get that type of victory. I mean, one of the things I'm wondering in the change, because, I mean, he has always gone through these stretches where, you know, he's in the fifth inning and he's up to 90-some pitches. I mean, in these last couple starts, there's been an economy of pitching that he's not, you know, throwing as many as he has before.
That's been all about strike one. That has been about going after the hitters and not worrying that I have to do this or hit this corner or hit my spots. That's been, you know, the confidence in getting ahead. Once he's ahead in the count, you know, the hitter's in trouble. And the problem was before, if the hitters were getting ahead in the count, even if he got back into the count, they were fouling pitches off, and that's where the pitch count was getting up, and it was a frustration of his. You know, as early as you know, spring training, it was something that he was talking about. And if the fastball is there, then he doesn't even need those secondary pitches. We saw that against Oakland. But the secondary pitches are better. He is setting them up better as well. You know, you saw the dominant stuff early from him last night, and Mike Zunino made him keep going back to that breaking ball, not so much for that moment in the first inning, the second inning, the third inning, but so that he would have the feel for that once they perhaps are trying to time up that fastball a little bit more later in the game. And at that point, the hitter's guessing and just really, really had no chance against him.
Yeah, so now how are they going to top this? Because, again, one of the special moments in Mariner history, but the series continues against Toronto tonight with Wade LeBlanc going on the mound.
Well, then maybe Wade LeBlanc throws one too. We'll see. You know, I think it's about getting back into, you know, winning the series. Their ultimate goal is more geared towards the end of the year than it is right now. So I think it's a matter of Paxton kind of enjoying his moment. And what is so amazing is he's been able to economize his pitches the last three outings. His arm is still very fresh right now. And, you know, I think that he's got a chance to get off on a roll like we saw last July, when he won 7 games in a month, which just doesn't happen. I think that he's pretty locked in right now. So, you know, he hands the ball to the next guy, and hopefully the Mariners score runs again like they did last night, get a couple of wins, and we see what James has got 5 days from now.
Well, Shannon, it was a special moment, and thanks for sharing it, because it was such a special night in Mariner history. Shannon Dreher, thanks for joining us on the Venue Kings Hotline.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next, and of course you can check out the show on the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. We'll catch up and talk a little bit of rookie mini camp with Dave Wyman. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And joining us on the Venue Kings Hotline is Dave Wyman. And, of course, switching gears here, talking a little football because it is still a lot of football stuff going on. Minicamp, rookie minicamp happened over the weekend. And I know you were kind of intrigued with the tight end situation.
Yeah, John, I was looking at not only, you know, we forgot about Tyrone Swoops, who was an 18-wheeler quarterback at Texas a couple years ago, and he was in camp. And but, you know, mostly what I was really impressed by was Will Dissly and just what the Seahawks have done at tight end in general. And, you know, I had somebody bring up the fact that, look, you know, look at Jimmy Graham's catches and everything and, you know, what you're getting with Ed Dixon and his number of catches and touchdowns. And the way I put it is, look, they want to emphasize the running game, and tight end, that position is changing now. And what you want is you want blockers there. You want guys like Zach Miller. And so I thought Ed Dixon, if you watch him, he can block from anywhere. Split him out wide, line him up as an inline tight end off the ball, even in the backfield. You know, he could be like sort of a multiplayer where I don't know if he's going to be playing special teams because he's an older guy, but you can line him up as a fullback. He's such a good blocker. So, you know, and I was looking at the difference between Ed Dixon, or, you know, you could throw Dissly in there too, and the difference between those two guys and Jimmy Graham. I'd say that they're both closer to being as good of a pass catcher as Jimmy Graham, much more than he is closer to them in being a blocker. Jimmy Graham was just not a good blocker. And, you know, I tried to make excuses for him. And I think finally, John, that last game against Arizona, he got whooped on a 3rd-and-1. And it was also a little bit on how they were using him. But he just could not block. It just wasn't what he's built for. And now you've got Ed Dixon, and you got, of course, Nick Vinette, and then Dissly looked really good. I thought of all the rookies, John, Will Dissly from University of Washington, he looked the best. And, you know, obviously they weren't blocking and they weren't running, you know, any kind of, you know, full contact running plays. But when I watched him go into the routes, he's actually, you know, everybody, I think, expected him to be this big lumbering offensive tackle type of guy, but he's got really soft hands. And he runs good routes, so I'm not saying he's going to come close to catching what Jimmy Graham caught, but he can catch the ball, and mostly he's a really good blocker.
Yeah, and I like the comment that he made. He says blocking is a want-to type of thing, and I thought it was kind of ironic. Here he is, you know, wearing Jimmy Graham's number, and I don't know. I mean, Jimmy Graham had a want-to. He just didn't have the ability to really do it. But, I mean, was there a want-to that might have been missing in Jimmy that you see in Dissly?
I think so, John. I don't want to trash Jimmy Graham too much on the way out because he is what he is. I mean, he himself petitioned to be a wide receiver when he was in New Orleans, and that's who he is. You know, I look at it this way, John. You know, when you block, there's a couple of different parts of the play. And the first part is, you know, your first step and how you hit a guy is sort of, I don't want to say it's guess, but you don't know if he's going to slant. You don't know if he's going to punch you. You don't know if he's going to headbutt you or whatever. And Jimmy was, you know, he had that first step that he would throw out there. And then if it didn't work, he didn't really readjust. He didn't try to drop his hips or move his feet to try to, because look, it's a battle. It's a fight. You know, it's like a tug of war. You know, it's, you have to reposition and constantly get in front of the guy. And, you know, if you want to call that want to, or just a skill that he didn't have, he didn't have it. I mean, he'd throw the first part out there, and if he didn't step to the right place or hit the guy the right way, then that was it for him. Whereas other tight ends and a guy like Will Dissly, he'll battle to get back in position and finish that block. So I think that's what I saw out of Jimmy. So I don't know if you want to say it was a lack of want to. It was just, he just didn't have the skill to readjust and block, and really ultimately I don't think he had the interest in that. You know, as a player, he just didn't really want to develop that part of it. It was all about catching passes and running routes for him. So it's just a different philosophy, I think, that the Seahawks themselves have changed, and that's what the tight end is going to look like. He's going to look much more like a guy like Will Dissly or Nick Vinette than, or Ed Dixon, than he is like Jimmy Graham.
So now the other part of this is that the surprise, I thought, was Alex Magoo, the seventh-round pick. Were you as impressed with him as I was?
Yeah, he looked really good. He looked like he was in command. And, you know, that's the thing when you see and it's tough for quarterbacks because, you know, you've got a bunch of guys. I mean, shoot, John, how many were there, 70 guys out there?
Yeah.
Something like that. I mean, 50 of them aren't even going to have a shot. And so you're working with a bunch of guys that, you know, and it's kind of all thrown together. And he just looked like he was in command. And, you know, the thing that Schneider said about him was that he's really – he had the second highest completion percentage while on the run or off the spot, you know, in other words, not in the pocket. And, you know, I think you have to give him a lot of credit. He was on a bad team. Florida International was not a good team. He was on the run quite a bit. And I think only Baker Mayfield had a better completion percentage sort of off the spot. So yeah, he looked really good. Boy, you look at his face. I mean, if he didn't have that stubble, I would think he was 12 years old. He's a young looking guy, but I thought, you know, he's very mature. I was impressed by his interview after practice. And, yeah, I think it'll be nice if they can develop him and he can be the second quarterback because, you know, you see the value in developing your own quarterback. And you see the Patriots did it, and there's been some other teams that have drafted guys later. And, you know, I know John Schneider is really excited about Alex Magoo, thinks he's going to be a player.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think and that looked really good. I thought that was one of the more impressive things because, again, you didn't expect it. Thoughts on Rashard Penny and how he looked?
Look good. You know, and the thing about him is, and this is why I think running back's a very, you know, valuable position that doesn't – it's not seen that way in the draft, and it's not seen that way as far as money, you know, as far as that position group. But – you know, the last 2 years, I was just watching some fantasy football guy on ESPN, but, you know, he pointed out the last 2 years, a rookie running back has led the league in rushing. It was Kareem Hunt last year, and the year before that, it was Zeke Elliott. And what I see out of Rashad Penny, John, first of all, is, and this is important, he is able to find the small cracks, and that's what Marshawn Lynch was able to do. Now, you go back and look, I mean, I know they put a lot of money into their offensive line and everything, but back in 13, 14, that was not a dominant offensive line. It was a dominant running game. And I've said this many times, but it was mostly because I think Marshawn found the cracks and he was able to do that. And that's what I see out of Rashad Penny. The other thing, too, is kind of stretch here, but it's imagination. It's like you sort of see things before they happen. And that's what you see Marshawn Lynch do that kind of thing. Watched a highlight the other day where he caught a swing pass and he juked both Ray Lewis and the corner. It was a game against Baltimore a few years ago and just broke both their ankles practically making a move. And that just comes from your imagination. And that's what I see out of Rashad Penny. He kind of sees the field, you know, and sees guys' body movements and things like that. And I saw that out of C.J. Procise, too, if he can just stay healthy. But, you know, the running back, you know, I feel like receivers, you know, there's a lot that they have to, that has to go right in order for them to catch a ball. And, you know, the offensive line has to block. The quarterback has to make a perfect throw. Running backs can kind of make their own way, even when there's nothing there. And that's kind of what Marshawn did. And that's what I'm seeing out of Rashad Penny. Now, watching him out at practice, I mean, he looked great, but you can't really tell that much. And that's what's tough about the running game these days because they just don't go full speed, full contact in practice, hardly at all. And that's where you really get the fits and you're able to see where the lanes are going to be. But from what I saw out there, you know, he looked great. But, you know, I think when you get in full speed, those are going to be two of the things that are going to set him apart. And I think, again, he has a chance to make an immediate impact on this offense and on this team.
Okay, of course, I saved this to the end. What do you have to say about the punter, Michael Dixon?
John, you know I texted Mara that if we get desperate for things to talk about, we're
right.
going to talk about the punter.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you were out there, man. You saw it. I was impressed, I have to say, and what they were doing at the end of practice. Now, he was over on the other field. I guess he was doing some drop kicks or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was, they had a little contest, which Pete loves to do, and I think it's really fun to watch. But he had the tight ends versus the linebackers catching his Dixon's punts, Michael Dixon's punts. And I'll tell you what, man, the way the punt came down out of the air was unusual. I mean, it was like a spiral and just heading straight down, and it almost seemed to pick up speed, and supposedly he can spin it different ways and everything, and it was really difficult for those guys to catch, although Shaquem Griffin caught his, which I thought was noteworthy because that was difficult. And for him to be able to catch that was great. But, yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing about the punter, though, and why I don't get too excited is that if you go and watch his highlights at Texas, he had some great cover guys. But, you know, the thing is, they got great cover guys here. You know, I think Nico Thorpe's the best coverage guy, the headhunter on the outside that there is in the NFL. He proved it time and time again last year. And so, you know, Coleman's really good out there. I know DeAndre Elliott can do that. So, you know, you can kick the ball as far as you want. If you don't coordinate it with those headhunters, it's not worth it, because if you kick it too far, the guy's going to have to back up to catch it, but there's going to be lots of space between him and the headhunter. And, you know, if you can coordinate it properly, at the end of the game, John, I always look at stats. We're getting ready to do the post-game show, and one of the stats I look at is average starting point. And I thought last year, if you go back to the New York Giant game, the punting game sort of kept them in that game early on, because they had some things that weren't working in the red zone, but they were winning the field position battle. And that comes from, you know, your punter. And John Ryan did a good job last year, but now you got a younger guy who's going to be cheaper, and you're going to save a lot of money, and it looks like he can do a good job. So, you know, he's going to have to battle it out, but I feel like he's sort of the favorite going into this year, just because he was drafted and because John Ryan's going to, you know, his salary is a lot more.
Okay, so that's Dave Wyman, and thanks for joining us in the Venue Kings Hotline. I'll miss you today because we got Mariner baseball.
Yeah, I know. Well, pretty exciting Mariner baseball, boy. That no-hitter last night couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
No, that was great. Hey, Dave, thanks for joining us,
awesome.
And you can check out the show in the 710 Sports app, driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Coming up next, we'll go behind the lines and catch up on some football stuff. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
And, of course, it's time to go behind the lines. And, of course, you know, the kind of a little slower part of the time. But, of course, we did have the official ending of unrestricted free agency yesterday. A few moves that have been made. I know that Mike Person, a veteran offensive lineman, just signed with San Francisco. And these are the times where you really try to pick up some bargains, pick up some guys that, not going to cost a lot. I mean, of course, it's just kind of filling out the roster, trying to make sure that, you know, all the good stuff is taken care of, but that's going to be one of the big things right now for the teams. And of course, if you have a need, try to go get it. In the meantime, you're that much closer to going ahead and getting the OTAs going, which start pretty much in another week or so. And that gives you 10 chances to go out there, be with the team, and then see how good it's going to be overall. So that's going to be kind of the interesting part. But I think most teams now are at the stage where I think you're seeing it. People are now making their forecast to see who's going to be there and who's not. I mean, in other words, what predictions are going to be. And that's why it's kind of interesting to see some of these forecasts where you have Seattle anywhere between 8 wins, 9 wins, and whatever, more 8 than 9, and see where all these predictions are going to go. So it's kind of interesting to see what everybody is thinking about this team. And I don't know, more it's like you still get the feeling that nationwide they're not into the Seahawks right now. They think that's a team that's lost a lot and not gained a lot, and yet we came from the mini camp and we think we saw some pretty good things.
Yeah, and I think there's something too. I've heard you say this too, that nationally people just think offensive line. But we know that they have actually invested into the offensive line. I just think that there were so many rotating things going on with Cable trying to kind of figure out where he wanted to put people and what he wanted to do with them, that I think that the Seahawks are hoping they can still salvage guys like Afedi and, get Posick in there and maybe get more out of Britt. And so they feel like they've already made those investments and that all these changes they've made to the coaching staff should help that pay off. But, everyone on the outside just kind of sees like their offensive line has been bad and Russell Wilson was running for his life and you didn't do anything on the offensive line, so you're going to be bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I think where everybody kind of overdoes it. I mean, again, this offensive line certainly has issues. It certainly has problems. I mean, it was not good the last couple of years, and it's so much work to try to make it good. But, you know, they only needed to get one starter this offseason, and whether he's the right one or the wrong one, but DJ Fluker was the one that they got, and now they'll see how they can do with him. But that's where I think everybody's kind of going crazy in this stuff because they're looking at it and go, wow, they've done nothing for the offensive line. I still think the one that was so bad with Sporting News does a thing where they said that I can't believe they didn't draft more offensive linemen and cornerbacks. It's like that's what they needed. Well, they got a cornerback. It's just that he was playing safety in college, and that cornerback looks pretty good when you see him matched up with a 6'3 arm, a 6'3 body, and 34-inch arm length. I mean, they look pretty good. So, you know, I think that they are going to be better than you would expect. In the meantime, everybody, rightfully so, is jumping on the Rams. I think that the Rams have got it. I'm a little surprised that there's such positive ratings overall about the 49ers. That one, I think, is maybe a little bit of an overdue, don't you?
I agree. I think, you know, Garoppolo did have such a strong showing at the end of the year. I understand why people believe in him. I do think he's going to be good, but they were a team with a lot of holes. They still have a lot of issues to address, and I think that there's still going to be some growing pains. I don't think Garoppolo is going to completely turn them around in one season.
No, I can't see that. I mean, because again, you know, I don't know if they're better with the running game. I mean, they make the move for Jerick McKinnon, who was a backup in Minnesota. Actually, it was more the third running back, but he has skills that I think fit what Kyle Shanahan wants. But is that going to be necessarily good enough? Because again, Carlos Hyde, I thought, was a good running back. Thought that, and now he's over in Cleveland, and they passed on, they didn't get a chance to get Saquon Barkley. They could have taken him at number one, but they needed a quarterback. I don't know if they still made the right move on Baker Mayfield. Hey, by the way, what'd you think about the Johnny Manziel having to be hospitalized because I guess he had some medication and it did not go right?
Yeah, I mean, that's sad to hear. I'm happy to hear that, you know, he apparently was diagnosed with bipolar and that he is taking medication for it and trying to get that straightened out. So it's just good to hear that he's getting the proper treatment. But apparently they changed something around and he didn't react well to it.
No, not at all. I just, you know, you hope that everything's going to be okay. I'll feel so much better about him once he starts to sign a deal and get up to Hamilton and start to play football. I mean, because again, I think he's just, you know, away from football too much. I think he's wasted his time right now trying to, go for that Austin, Texas spring league where he only had two games. I mean, that was a waste of time and a waste of, so he needs to get to Hamilton as quickly as possible and start getting his football career back, because I think that he wants it and you'd like to see him do it, because again, he was so good in college, but he had so many problems. But he needs a structured system in the National Football League.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's going to be a long while if we do see him again at all, but it's good to hear that he's going to try to go get that experience. I know you were very against him just trying to back his way back into the league.
Yeah, well, again, you saw how many teams really jumped on board and said, oh yeah, we really want to have Johnny Manziel. I think the answer was none. I mean, you know, there was the rumor that New England did it, but did New England do anything with him? And the answer was no. So just don't see it. I think that, get to Hamilton as quickly as possible. Hey, you can check out the show and the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Well, again, a lot of time we're going to be spending. And don't forget, the Air Mariners take on the A's Blue Jays today. That game's going to be at 4:07 with the pregame at 3. And so coming up next, we're going to check in with Rick Riz as he relives the magic moments of James Paxton's no-hitter, which was last night, 99 pitches. Most every one of those pitches were precious. We'll talk to Rick Riz next. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.